G'day there, and welcome to our Everyone Has a Story podcast, the podcast that complements the two quarterly lifestyle magazines, Hello Sunshine magazine and In Noosa magazine. The summer issues, the bumper summer issues of both of those publications out on the streets right now. And if you'd like your brand, business to be part of the autumn issue, reach out to our customer service managers. You can find us on Facebook and you can find us on Instagram. On with today's episode of Everyone Has a Story. My next guest is a household name, although there are many aspects of his life and career that I was unaware of, and I'm sure you'll find this episode equally fascinating and inspirational. We talk about his travels and his work all over the globe, dealing with racism in Sydney when he was a kid back in the 70s, and we discuss his passion and love of food. Everyone has a story, and today I'd like you to meet Peter Kuravita.
Peter, you are born in London, travelled all over the world, lived all over the world, and even with your career, you've travelled and seen a fair bit of the world.
Yeah.
Why is it that... How long have you been here in Noosa?
We're just about to get to 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why have you decided, and your family decided, to make this your base, your home?
Well, it started off with a job opportunity or a restaurant opportunity. So I had restaurants in the Pacific... five in the Pacific with Starwood Hotels in Fiji and Samoa. And then I was in Sydney 2012, 2014, and I ended up having a bust up with my business partner of Flying Fish. And so at the same time, the restaurants in the Pacific were going, and I got a phone call from an American guy, and he was the head of Blackstone, who just bought, they'd just bought the Sheraton Noosa. And he just said, hey, I've been speaking to the food and beverage director worldwide of Starwood, and he said that you do restaurants well and you want to come over. And so I thought, yeah, sure, because I was actually standing on the grass. I remember it clearly in our house in Zetland, standing on the grass thinking, okay, what are we going to do? Because the Fiji places don't give us enough income, so I wanted to start something new. And I was just looking. And so this just popped up. And so for the first couple of... nearly for the first year, I FIFO'd backwards and forwards from Noosa to Sydney. And the defining moment, well, there were many moments. I travelled a lot, as you said. I was away for at least 6 months of the year every year. And the dread I always had was returning back to Sydney Airport and getting into one of those stinking taxi cabs with a grumpy taxi driver who'd been there for 3.5 hours and hoping to get a trip to Blacktown.
Yeah.
I was in Zetland, which is... probably 12 k's away at the most, but just outside the zone where they could turn around and come back to the front of the line. So it always started with an argument.
Yeah.
You'd see the guy would get angry as soon as you hopped in the cab and said Zetland. You could see he was angry, and it, by the time I got home, 9 times out of 10 we'd be screaming at each other. And so one day I just had enough. I opened all 4 doors, the boot, walked out so that he had to get out of the cab and close them all, walked into the house and just said to Karen, let's go to Noosa.
Yeah.
And that was really it. She was shocked. And it was really, you know, it was like, what about the boys? One's in year 7, one's in year 8, the other one's in primary school. And I just said, look, I've moved around the world all my life. I think in my very small and short school term, I think I did 6 schools in 3 countries.
Yeah.
So and it made me strong. So that part didn't worry me.
Yeah.
So I came up for the last time. We looked at renting, and the guys had never seen. And I found this house, and even this house that we're in now, it was really strange. It was just a 2-line ad. I've had a lot of 2-line ads in my life, but this 2-line ad was like 4-bedroom luxury home for rent. Email. That was it. So I was like, that's weird. So I emailed them. I got an email back about 5 minutes later saying, this is the address, come and visit. I was trying to figure out what it was. And when I came in, the 2 people that owned it, you could tell that they knew who I was straight away.
Okay.
So they'd studied me.
All right.
it was weird.
Yeah.
It ended up that he was an ex-SAS soldier, still active in, you know, I don't know what. And she used to do all the secretarial work. So one of these rooms actually is nearly a safe room in this house. It's crazy.
I wonder what he was expecting.
Oh, no, well, no. See, I think they were screening people like that.
Yeah. Right.
So we rented it.
Yeah.
And I went back to Sydney. I didn't tell them anything about the house because we'd looked at a few. You know, when you came in, you asked about the waterfront. looked on the riverfront and I thought, I don't want to be bitten by midges. That was number one. And I found this house to rent on the waterfront, but it didn't have a swimming pool. So I thought, and Karen just went, no. And it was so hard. Noosa now is hard to find accommodation. Even 9 years ago, it was quite hard. And so anyway, when we walked in the door here, they were blown away. And that was quite an easy adjustment for them. Local school, everyone was happy. The boys were going to a all-boys school in the middle of Bondi, which was, to me, looked like a prison cell, like it was just this block of testosterone. Mm. And so they came here to a school full of blonde-haired, blue-eyed girls. They were quite happy. And, it was a really nice, easy transition. And then a year later, they were trying to sell this house and we bought it.
Right.
So this is the only house we've ever lived in Noosa.
Yeah. But, again, you've travelled around the world. What keeps you coming back? Surely there are a lot of beautiful places around the world.
Not as beautiful as this.
Yeah.
Seriously.
That's good to hear. That's interesting to hear that.
There is nothing as... Like, I love Sri Lanka. There are some beautiful, unspoiled beaches. Life is very easy. We would never have to work another day. I could do a few promotional things. Some money comes easily. You'd have drivers and cooks and housemaids and all of that. But it doesn't have this incredible serenity that is Noosa. I just took the dog for a walk on the beach today. It was just me, 47 Ks of beach and just myself. I mean, it was raining. But even then, there's the water's clear, the temperature's good. I like this temperature. It was actually really good for me too, traveling so much, that I was already acclimatized, because most of my travels were in the South Pacific and Asia. And so getting out of a plane in this humid weather into a humid country, I was instantly acclimatized. And we love this weather. Yeah. So there's so many things. As a chef, the ocean to the hinterland has a bounty of amazing produce. And we're trying to use all of that. I always have. When I came here, I think the second year I was here, we made a TV show about this area called Coastal Kitchen, and it was just, I just discovered so much, and I'm still in touch with those people. I'm buying my eggs from those guys now for the new restaurant, and we're still in touch with everybody. I saw Auntie Dale just recently, and that kind of connection and the passion that people have here.
Yeah.
So people make sea changes and tree changes. Very rarely can a chef make one of those and still be surrounded by incredible produce. So it's a full draw card for me. And then 370 meters to the beach, we all surf. There's so many amazing things about Noosa, and that's just scratching the surface. Fraser Island, driving on the beach, it's just... It's incredible. There is no other better.
Yeah, I have a good friend who's travelled a lot as well, and one of his favourite lines is, the best thing about travel is coming home.
Yes.
Because you see other parts of the world, you have an appreciation for how pristine our environment is.
And true.
Same for me, I go to Italy. I love Italy as my heritage.
Yes.
And there are beautiful places. But then you come here and the environment, it doesn't even match how pristine our environment, how clean our waterways are and things like that. I want to go all the way back to, so you're born in London, but you didn't stay there long.
4 years.
Four years. And it was really the swinging 60s, but I don't imagine you have many, many memories of London in the 60s.
Not really. My parents used to have a lot of parties. So a lot of the Sri Lankan boys that came over in the same time, it seemed to be, it was the motherland, really.
Well, why did your dad go to...
He wanted to see the coronation of Queen Elizabeth. So he rode his motorcycle.
53?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
So he rode his motorcycle, Indian motorcycle with a sidecar, four Sri Lankan boys in it.
Yeah.
Only two of them made it to London. The others went home.
Oh.
And but he missed it by a couple of days, the coronation. And then my mother was coming from Vienna after the war. It was 53, so just after the war. Her father was in a prisoner of war camp, in a concentration camp. He was Austrian, but he was still put away because he didn't want to become Nazi. While he was away, his wife and my mum's mother was killed by a hand grenade while holding her hand. And so, it affected my mum a lot. And then when her father came home, he married the classic evil stepmother. And so it wasn't really a good environment. So she came to London to learn how to be a Montessori teacher. And the first person she met was my dad.
Yeah. And what was he doing?
He was an engineer. So he came here, finished off his engineering degree to England, finished off his engineering degree, and then started his own workshop. And he was... For many years, when we got to Australia in the 70s, he was in great demand because he was like one of the most experienced diesel engine engineers as well as aeronautic engineers. So he farmed himself out.
Was it a big family, many siblings? Like
I've got two brothers.
Yeah.
And like I've got three boys, I've got two brothers. But our family in Sri Lanka was large because everybody lived in the same compound. Four families and the grandparents. So there was 22 of us in this giant compound with three houses, and it was an amazing thing. So that whole family feel has still stuck with me. It's really part of my life, very much like Italy, I guess. You know,
well, family's important. Meal is important.
It is.
Is it the same for like Sri Lankans?
And for us, the meal.
It's
every
about
meal
family
is
and getting around a meal, isn't
for
it?
For sure. Yeah, I mean, we're on a round table. This is where we eat. It's nice.
And so, where did the passion for food and cooking?
I think everyone cooked. My dad cooked. My mum cooked. And you know, you think about two cultures so far apart. Mum making brawn out of pig's head and phyllo pastry by hand, and right now she'll be making all the Christmas biscuits for this Christmas.
Your mum and dad still alive?
Yeah. My mum's alive. My dad was 20 years older than my mum, so he'd be 100 and something now. Right, yeah, he's long gone, 20 or so years ago. And he cooked as well because he was always trying to replicate his mother's food. You know, one of the youngest food memories I have is in London still, and my dad coming home after work and mixing some rice and dal and popping it into my mouth. And I just remember rough fingers, diesel, because he was an engineer, and there's delicious food.
Yeah.
And then when we got to Sri Lanka, it was the same. Food was life. Food was health. Food was medicine.
Yeah.
It wasn't just food. And that conversation about food was constantly there. It was always there. It was all just part of everyday life.
In an endeavor to educate you about food, because it was interesting. My background is, you know, Italians. I had a mother who was a very good cook, but always provided for the family, but never really taught me how to cook. I just was a silent observer.
Yeah.
I've become a good, I think I do okay these days, and I have an interest in trying to find, because my parents are long gone, but try to find the recipes for things like oxtail ragu, which I'm kind of have to ask my sister about. But they never taught me about food. I was part of that culture, but I was never taught. I had to learn later. And I know a lot of, you know, the sons of Italian parents, they're kind of a bit hopeless, really. You know, they go from being under the mother's apron to then the wife's. So it's interesting. But you were taught about,
well, Sri Lankan,
about creating, you know.
Yeah, I think what you've learned first, and that's, you can ask any Sri Lankan this, and they'll know the medicinal benefits of all the food. And you ask them how they know, they don't know. So this is just something that's handed over. And food is medicine. Everything from digestion to infection to stomach aches to cancer to inflammation to all of those. Ayurveda plays a part in the entire daily life. So when you're a kid, depends on the kid. It's very much the same with children in Sri Lanka, especially the boys. They're very spoiled. You know, they're still considered children at 22, 23, and it's like, that's not how my boys are brought up.
but
if you're not interested, most of the men would come in and taste something and go, oh, it needs a bit more salt. That was their input. For me, because, you know, mum was struggled to settle into Sri Lanka. It was hard for her. Just a new country.
Yeah.
You know, it was 1969. Rolling electricity strikes, mosquitoes, you know, the whole thing. She got dengue fever and she got quite sick, and I guess in some ways felt quite isolated too because of this massive family. And in the end, she became really close to my grandmother. And the only person of that generation that's still alive is my auntie, because she was a mistake, born 20 years later. And so her and my mum shared the same birthday, 3-4 days apart. They were both in their 80s. So that's the last link to that. And those two women, my two aunties, the older one's long gone, and my grandmother, those three women were in the kitchen all the time. So I had nothing to do other than play in the dirt. My dad had a big factory and foundry working away. He brought everything from England. And so I would just go and hang in the kitchen. And they made a little stool for me. And I asked enough questions, I guess, and they kept telling me when they went across the road to the market, the ladies would get dressed from their house clothes into a sari just across the road.
Yeah.
And then you'd hang on their sari tails and walk through the market, which has been there for hundreds of years. And, you know, your grandmother would just say, or your auntie would just say, this is what this is for, this is what this is for. And then I got favourites, you know, breadfruit curry from Auntie Padmini is always my favourite. So whenever I go there, if the breadfruit season, she always cooks me breadfruit. My grandmother used to make me cashew curry, but they'd always roll their eyes because people don't realise that a cashew is the only nut that grows outside the fruit. So it looks like a very small choco, goes bright red, and from the bottom this black pod hangs out the shape of a cashew. But in the markets, they sell them in the black pod. When you cut them open, the milk that comes out of it will strip the skin off your fingers. That's why cashews are so expensive. They have to be hand extracted. So they'd put coconut oil on their hands and then peel each one. So they'd always roll their eyes, but they'd make it for me. Auntie Nanda used to always make drumstick curry. So I just got interested, and I think I got interested in the mechanics of it, because my grandmother never used powders. We had this thing called the Mirascala. Mirascala literally means chili stone. And it's a mortar and pestle in the shape of a grinding stone. So and at every household who's had them, ours must be 300 years old. And every household that has them, depending on the person that used it, one stone won't fit onto another mortar because they're customized, and yeah. We've been eating bits of granite for centuries, you know.
Yeah.
But she used to make all her curry paste. So she'd get all the fresh and dried ingredients, crush them up, mix them with water. They'd have salt in a bottle, and you know, in some of the old Sri Lankan recipe books, it says add a little salt. People are like, what the hell does that mean? Or one bottle of oil. So a bottle of oil was a beer bottle, and when the man came in the bullock cart with the oil in a big drum, you'd take the oil from it. So, you know, lots of just interesting things. And the salt was just rock salt thrown into a beer bottle filled with water. Depending on how much water there was in there was the salinity of the water.
Yeah.
So all these little, you know, things. And then she'd grind it up, and you'd have these vibrantly coloured chili pastes sitting above the open fireplace, because yeah. It was all wood fire. The kitchen was called a black kitchen because it was just full of soot. And that's where they cooked. And you know, she'd take a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So that was a real interesting part for me. It really, I don't know, it just took my time. I loved being with them, just natter.
Yeah.
Listening to them natter.
Yeah.
You know, there'd be very routines in the morning. The men would go off to work. The women would go and have a bath by the well, you know, and a certain amount of buckets. You had to count the amount of buckets depending on the season and the weather, and yeah, you know, all of this.
Water was scarce, yeah.
No, it wasn't. Water was scarce. It's that you had, there was an amount of buckets that you put
on right.
Before you put soap, then after you put soap. It was just this thing, this ritual.
Yeah, ritual, yes, that's the word.
And then afterwards, they'd all sit in the courtyard, and one of the houseboys would have gone and gotten the rice. And while their hair was drying, maybe one of the younger women would be braiding the hair, and then just chat. And they would sift through the rice. So they just, using their hand, just push each grain aside and pull out little rocks so that no one broke their teeth. And the guys in the markets would just add a handful of granite to the rice to make it more heavy so they got more money.
Yeah, right.
So it was a daily routine of checking through your rice. And that was, you know, the sun was just dappling through, just beautiful memories. And then they go into the kitchen and cook. And they'd cook not necessarily what people requested, but depending on the health of the family. And that was really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, if people had a cold, you wouldn't get any cooling food. They had all these rules. You know, I got, one of my big trips away, by the time I got to Colombo, I'd been in India backpacking for a year. I was 38 or 40 kilos. I had malaria, some kind of other viral fever that no one could figure out. I was totally, I was near death. And I lay for 9 days. I can't remember what they'd rang my parents and said, I think he's going to die. You should come over. My dad said he'll be all right. my grandmother never checked my temperature here. She'd always sit. And by that time, her eyesight was fading. So she'd sit on the end of the bed and just hold my foot. And she could tell by holding my foot how my whole body was. And all I wanted was a mango. And she just wouldn't allow it because she said, no, that's cooling. It's not good for you. And she gave me other fruits. So she, you know, knew. And when I came out of it, she was there, you know, and it was amazing. So, yeah, food and medicine and life and all of those just were so intertwined, you couldn't separate it.
Being steeped so deeply into that traditional form and the way that things, you know, what you just explained and described, Was it difficult then moving into, or when you kind of started your, like moving into a commercial kitchen? Like did that, how did that transition happen? Did you have to kind of compromise for the way you were taught? And
I think they just went hand in hand. It made me better because I understood food.
So where
already.
Was that? Where did you first walk into?
It was called Crabapple Restaurant in Mortdale in Sydney, which is in the southern suburbs. In the Shire, it was a 10-minute walk from our house.
But I imagine that was very different to the scene that you just kind of described.
But there was a few years of extreme hardship in between that. Yeah. And that extreme hardship was basically bullying and racism and all of that. So those memories...
In Sydney.
Yeah, when we arrived in Blacktown in 1974. I mean, if anyone knows Blacktown, Blacktown now is a mega city. It's a metropolis. There was the railway station and three shops. We used to go riding horses in Mount Druitt. Mount Druitt now is just these, you know, 400 square metre houses as far as you can see. So it was a very different time. But White Australia policy had just wound down.
So what was it, 1974?
74, yeah.
Right.
So, you know, my mum always says you can criticise Gough Whitlam for anything you like, but he's the one who got us into this country. Because that was the stage when they opened it up. My dad was 48, so the cutoff was 50. We had to get out of Sri Lanka, and the choice was going back to London.
Why did you have to get out of Sri Lanka?
Oh, the war had started. The government had leaned pro-communist, so my father's business was struggling because imports were hard. And there was a lot of weird rules coming in. And Dad had a lot of affiliations with the military and the police. And, you know, that we had armed soldiers in our house all the time because Dad had lots of vehicles, so he'd lend them to the military when they went out on their details to clean up terrorists and stuff. And that was a daily thing. We didn't have TV. We ran to the end of Auntie Nanda's house, which was opposite the road, diagonally opposite the road to the police station, the main police station. And so we'd gobble our food down because 6 o'clock was curfew every night. If you were on the street, you'd get a hiding from the police. Mm. So that was our TV. We'd run to see who had missed curfew. And as they go past, the police would give them a good whack across the back of the head. It was just getting worse and worse. Bodies was a normal thing, you know, little explosions here. And then this is before the Tamil Tigers. Yeah, This was the JVP who were actually rebelling. And now they're a main political party who were actually rebelling against the government. So it was quite intense.
So in contrast to that, and you spoke about how hard and the bullying in White Australia, how did you cope? What was that like?
You know, we were living like little princes in that house. And, you know, Dad had all the passes during the curfew. So we'd be in his Mercedes standing outside on his roof, with the roof open, flying down Gaul Road with a big pass, and all the soldiers knew us. So we felt quite privileged. Came into here, we were nothing. We were nothing, nowhere. My dad always used to say he'd prefer to be a big fish in a small bowl than a small fish in a big bowl.
Right.
And so we all experienced this. Who are we? Where are we from? No one cares. You know, all
were there
of that
other
stuff.
Sri Lankans around?
No.
No.
Well, see, my father, and I agree with this and always have, I think it's good to go out on your own. There are ghettos of all kinds of communities around, and they still think that they are, and it's a bad word, it's not a ghetto, but there are communities and people gravitate to each other. And I think sometimes, this is my opinion only, but I think sometimes they don't embrace the new place, and they just sit there talking about the old place and how good it used to be. It's like, well, if it's that good, go back.
Yeah.
You know, so Dad was a pioneer. No Sri Lankan would go away from his mother at his age and go and make their own fortune in London. And so that adventurous spirit was always there. So this move, Dad wanted to go back to London. We had a house in Fulham. God knows what it'd be worth now. He sold it for about £15,000 and bought our first house in Sydney. But it was a different kind of environment. And it was easy to do. You just had to fight.
Yeah.
And that's what Dad said. Dad said, it's up to you. You can take it. Like, Dad used to get bullied at work as well, but he was good at what he did. So he managed to just understand. Not bullied, just teased. You know, just the things that got said in the 70s, you could never say today.
Yeah.
But the school was worse. The school was people physically intimidating you. And so I just became a good fighter. I'd just fight until they knocked me down. I'd get up and keep fighting, and I just wouldn't stop.
Your kids are all adults now, right?
Yeah.
I've got a 12-year-old. What advice did you give them, or how did you...
My sons?
Yeah, in terms of dealing with people, the kind of people that you dealt with.
You don't have to deal with them here. Yeah. We're in this society that's so softened and, you know, it's gentle and nice and nurturing, and which is good, but... I just think it's good to know how to fight as well, not physically, but how to deal with serious adversity. and you make that choice. You make that. There's nothing about whether you want to. You know, my dad said it to me. It's like whichever path you choose, I don't mind. You can take it and just be quiet. And some of the kids did. I saw that there was a kid from Mauritius there, Joseph Jugaru. I still remember his name. He got teased a lot, but he was a very smart kid. He's probably a doctor somewhere now. He just dealt with it. It just brushed off his thing. But for me, I wasn't going to put up with that. I just fought them.
Yeah,
it was just.
And then did you experience that when you went into like your first commercial kitchen?
No, it was the most nurturing thing. So we can wind back. Same suburb, Peakhurst High School I went to, which was a walk down one way, and if you walk the other way, you got to Mortdale Shops, and that's where the restaurant was. And Dad, I didn't know what to do, but I knew that I was allowed to leave school at 15 and 9 months.
And he was so cool with that.
He had no choice.
Yeah.
And I told him that. You've got no choice. So he said, okay, because, you know, we've got all the engineers, Montessori teachers, my brother, science, and then became an officer in the Navy. My younger brother's a pilot, engineer. Aviation master, and there's me. And so I just said, I'm leaving. And he said, okay, all right, I get it.
To do what? To go
I had no idea.
Oh, okay.
I had no idea. I just wanted to get out of school. I wanted to get away from those people.
Yeah.
And during those years in Sri Lanka, Dad, we never saw a tradesperson. We did it all ourselves. So Dad was going, well, you can repair cars. You know electrical. You've done plumbing. You've built stuff with me. So we did everything. I mean, some of them weren't quite right, but we did absolutely everything.
Yeah.
And so it was my hands. And so he said, well, you know, I know all the guys around here, all the different workshops, the plumbing, the electrical. And I was just like, I've done it for 5 years already, Dad. I've done my apprenticeship. I don't want to do it. And so he said, okay, that's fine. And he retired early at 52. He came home one day and said, I've had enough. I'm done. And then started jewelry shops and secondhand furniture shops. And that was another adventure, another path that he took. But normally myself and my older brother were the ones, he'd go, oh, I've just bought an entire apartment contents in one of the houses, units in Mortdale. No lifts, 5 stories. So we'd empty an entire house into a HR station wagon and bring it to the shop. So yeah, it was lots of fun times. But I really didn't know what to do, and he just said, just ride with me every day and we'll see what happens. And he was the one that stopped outside the restaurant and said, you like cooking? And he just bang, brought it back. You look like cooking with your grandmother, right? I was like, yeah, but so? He said, well, there's a restaurant, go and ask for a job. And I walked into this place, young chef, family business, mum and dad, brother, sister, their partners, 6 people, little restaurant called the Crab Apple, cooking classic old school French food. You know, learning how to make brown sauce and, you know, all of those béarnaise, hollandaise, all those classics, white bechamel and, you know, veal masala and, you know, green peppercorn, lobster thermidor, lobster mornay, you know, all that old stuff.
Yeah.
And they were just so nurturing, and they gave me a knife, and first thing I did was cut garlic bread, and they were impressed at how quick I was. And I got the job straight away, and I did the trial for 2 and a bit hours, and then Dad was still waiting outside. And that was it. I got the job. About 3 weeks after that, I moved out of home, down the road into the chef's house next to the bottle shop, across the road from the restaurant. And I was there for about 1.5 years. And then we moved to Bondi. So at the age of 17, I was living in Bondi with 2 other chefs.
Yeah. Mm. And it sounds, obviously, you're talking about how adventurous your dad was and how driven he was in terms of, even though he decided to retire at 52 and then started kind of dabbling in these other sidearms. That was the motivation, I get, and the catalyst for you to when did you open your first restaurant to become a businessman and go, well, I'm going to actually own one now and run it?
It was in the 90s.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think the apprenticeship stages. And in those days, the apprenticeship was 4 years.
Yeah.
Now you can get away with it in a year and a half, and really not sure sometimes. You know, it's another conversation, but I don't think we're teaching our apprentices enough at the moment. I think the apprenticeship should go back to 4 years. But I was just listening to something there about how about 30% of apprentices don't finish their apprenticeships.
And why is that? What's the reason?
I don't know. It must be workplace-based. I'm not sure. I didn't really listen to the rest of it, but it was a striking figure. The other part in our industry, in the hospitality industry, is people are reluctant to take apprentices, and we're in a real quandary right now with staff. And I truly believe that no one has paid attention on bringing young people through the ranks. We relied on international labour, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But I think now we're paying for it. And so for me, an apprenticeship is so important. We've already employed two apprentices and three trainees in Alba. And I continue to do that. It's just the reluctance. But if you don't teach people, then who's going to take the next step? So I was lucky to be in that place and have Scott teach me well.
Yeah.
And then from there, I just kept going, kept learning, kept... Once I got to Bondi, I was in the elite group of chefs. Not myself, but working for the elite group of chefs. Neil Perry was still a baby then. He wasn't on the market. Yeah. He wasn't there. We're talking Tony Bilson, Greg Doyle, Peter Doyle, not the Fish Doyles. They were around as well, and they were booming their businesses. But the Doyle brothers, Est and what was it called? Pier Restaurant. Mark Armstrong had a restaurant called Pegram's, and there was also Anders Ausback at the Yellow Book. And then there was like Beppi's and all those guys, all those Italian guys that had been there for even longer.
Mm.
But this. You know, fine dining, I think Nouvelle Cuisine was around then. This group of people, Tony led the way. Actually, just before Tony died, I found one of his books. Well, it was actually Michel Girard's book that he'd written in there, Dear Tony, you know, whatever. And I sent it back to Tony. We were in touch all the way to the end. But he led the way with his food, that fine French food. And then Greg Doyle was into that as well. So we were cooking food that no one else in Australia was cooking at that time. And I'm not sure what was going on in the Melbourne market in the you know, late 70s. I really don't. Because I started my apprenticeship in 1979. So about 81, 82, I was in Sydney. And I finished it by 83, 84 and headed overseas. But in that time, I just put my hand up and worked for everyone. So I tried to work 7 days a week. I worked a lunch here, and I had my job with Greg, which was Tuesday to Saturday nights. But then I'd try and do a lunch here and there, like a Friday lunch with someone, and I'd do a Sunday lunch with Peter Doyle at Reflections.
Yeah.
And, you know, just put my hand up so that I could learn all the time, and just, you know, partied like crazy too. You know, don't know how I actually did it, but it wasn't about the money. I think I was paying $20 a week for a flat in Bondi. There was three of us paying $60 a week. It was different times.
Yeah.
We lived in Bondi for 3 years. I think I went to the beach twice.
Right.
It was more nightclubs
and
kitchens.
Yeah. We spoke about your, you know, the transition and how you ended up here in Noosa. And I mean, there's a lot. You know, we could talk about this for hours.
Oh, I know.
But let's talk about Alba. What was your goal, I guess, for this new place? What did you want to achieve with this, with Alba?
I thought flying Noosa Beach House was my last restaurant. I'd said to Karen, I don't want another restaurant.
You didn't
want to
do it yet.
So Stoddart's, who is one of Australia's oldest stainless steel manufacturing companies, who also sell food service equipment, they approached me about 4 months before I left. They, out of the blue, got a phone call. Dave Richardson called me and said, hey, would you like to have one of our brand new ovens? Italian, you'd like that? Giorgic. It's, you know, the latest in the combi oven thing. And would you like to place it into the hotel? And I was like, yeah, because everything in that kitchen, Noosa Beach House kitchen, was broken and didn't work. And so I was like, yeah, sure. But then they weren't quite sure, and I wasn't quite sure, because I kind of knew that my contract was coming to an end and wasn't sure if I'd renew it or if they'd renew it. So I said to those guys, look, maybe it's not a good idea, because if I leave, you're going to have to pull this out. So everyone decided, because it was for me, it wasn't for the hotel. And then I said, look, what I'd like to do is start a cooking school. And they were like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. And I said, I'll find the premises. Would you furnish me with the equipment? So we went from one oven to $150,000 worth of
the
equipment.
The opportunity to work with this brand of oven?
And then for me, okay, I said to Karen, okay, let's find a shed in Coolum or in Noosa, like one of those commercial things. Let's set up a cooking school, and then I can do all the other things I've always wanted to do. My own line of products and, you know, all of that while we run cooking classes. So we're looking, and prices were just climbing. This is just at that crazy boom. Yeah. So a $200,000 commercial unit in Coolum or in Noosa had gone to $500,000 to $700,000. So that's a lot of money. I was looking at my super and I was trying to figure out how we're going to get around this. I got a phone call from Alex and Rob, who are the developers of Park Ridge. And 5 years prior to that, I got a phone call from them and they said, can you come and have a look at our business? Because we're not, you know, we're just about building it. And at that stage, that whole area was just a sand dune with two display units on it. Beautiful views over Lake Weber, and like, it was incredible. And so I looked at it and they were talking about it, and they were saying, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And eventually they said, do you want it? And I was like, no, not at the moment. I'm busy. I've got Noosa Beach House going. I just want to wait. So that was the end of that. It opened. It did okay. COVID got in the way. There was a few building concerns about noise because it's in an amphitheater. So they weren't having the easiest time. And part of that whole development was that there was going to be a food and beverage experience there. So I get a phone call out of the blue, Alex again, saying, hey, do you want to come and have a look and give us a hand because, you know, we need to jiggle this around. So I was more than happy and I looked around and I was saying, that needs to move there and you should do this and you should do that. And there was one room that was all blacked out. It's 500 square meters, this property. It's large. One room that was blacked out. And I said, what's in there? And he said, oh, we just use it for a storeroom. He popped it open. I said, this could be a good cooking school. And so their eyes lit up and I said, I've got the equipment. And then it was like, well, what about the rest? And I ended up going, okay, well, bugger it. May as well do one last restaurant. Now, one last restaurant, who knows? You know, that may not be the case.
Never say never.
That's right. But the thing about it was, this place, I didn't want to just have a restaurant. Didn't want to just have a restaurant. It had to be many revenue streams. And that's when I was talking, we'll move the pizza oven there. We need a cafe. There's no coffee. There's nowhere to buy milk in Park Ridge. You have to come to the junction. So I was thinking, okay, then we build a providor so that we can provide that service. And it just grew and grew and grew. The restaurant and then a bar and a cocktail bar and then takeaway and then Sunday roasts. And, you know, it's what I do.
Yeah.
And it just made sense. And it was... Then
the community to support it as well.
Yes, well,
great.
I hope so. You know, that's...
Yeah, I know where Park Ridge is. We've had a launch party there a couple of years ago. Yeah. And so, you know, being kind of the focal or central kind of hospitality for all those residents there.
Yeah.
And will you take the cooking class? Like, who
will
do that?
Well, we're just actually building our way through the curriculum now. So we'll release it every 3 months. Lewis Tickram's coming on board. I just spoke to Luke Mangan this morning. I'm hoping to get David Rayner.
And this will be something where just punters off the street
can
come in, like Zeb was doing at Wasabi there. Great.
So I'll be doing some of them. Yeah. There'll be we'll do wine appreciation courses. The thing about this cooking school is that it's a fully wired studio. So people can rent it out and shoot their YouTube movies there. It's ready to go. You can plug big cameras into it and make a TV show if you wanted to. So it's a studio for hire as well. It will have 18 people hands-on, 32 classroom style, where the chef demonstrates. We're also going to have a chef's kitchen. So it's the newest destination to come to, where, you know, you and 11 of your friends can come and sit in this area and be served by a chef and a sommelier. So it's that full interactive chef's kitchen, you know, like Tet still does in Singapore. So there's just that really close interaction, the studio, as I said. So there's many, many uses for that. And the design of it is beautiful. The lady, H&G Designs, Hayley, my wife Karen chose her because she did Market Bistro. And we really liked that simplicity but beauty of Market Bistro. There were a couple of other designers thrown in there, but most of them were interior designers, and we needed people who understood restaurants.
Yeah.
So from that moment, I grabbed her by the hand, stood at the front, and I said, this is my vision. Cafe, pizzeria, cooking school, provador, bar, breakfast, lunch and dinner restaurant, Sunday brunch. I want it to be like the best hotel lobby you've ever walked into. So where you walk, you know, when you walk into a hotel lobby and there's a coffee machine and there's a cafe and there's a bar and there's this and that. This is a house of brands. So when you walk in, you can just come and have a nibble and a drink. You can eat a lobster if you like, or a tomahawk steak. Yeah. You can have rice and curry. You can sit in the restaurant, which is an intimate 55-seater, which will just flip. And that'll just be partitioned with beautiful linen curtains. So it's all one area. It'll all work together.
Yeah.
I've had many nightmares about how the bloody thing's going to work.
Yeah.
You know, but we've been very lucky to get all of our staff.
Oh, good. No, because I have spoken to other people in hospitality, and there is a squeeze on getting
some really, really good people have just come my way, and it's been good. Amazing. Good. You know, we're short a couple. We've got one stuck in Sydney. We've got one waiting to get his visa. But I can open, and I can open at full capacity, which is really good.
You're pretty kind of clued on in terms of the marketing strategy as well. You've ridden that wave at the TV show TV shows and docos over a number of networks. When you mentioned the ability to shoot your own YouTube, I'm guessing now you're a brand name on your own.
Yeah.
Have you got the ability to go? You don't need traditional networks anymore, but you've got the ability. You've got a digital presence and
that's
the opportunity
right.
to film and you go straight out of there, I suppose,
right.
as well, which is, you must be exploring.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I'm telling other chefs they can do the same from that space.
Great.
Because with Dilmart, I worked a lot with Dilmart, still do. Over the last 30 years, I've been their right-hand man when it comes to food, or left-hand, if it's in my case. But and all of those jobs involved traveling somewhere.
Yeah.
And now, since COVID, it's all been in this kitchen at home, and I've set up a little camera, and I've done all the Zooms and everything.
Yeah, great.
But, you know, like what Zeb did at the Wasabi Cooking School, the big problem with that cooking school was that the chef faced the wall. You know, it was like a traditional kitchen. There was the hob didn't face the guests. It was on the wall. So to me, that cooking school didn't make much sense. I'm not sure how they went. Whereas this one is facing, so people can see it. There's cameras looking down into it. And so I did all of that Zoom stuff from home. Now I'll be able to take it there. And then that will help take our presence further. Dilmar will obviously want to use it more,
and
I can do more of that with other people. Like, there's just out there on the deck, there's that's a full hob from Ilvi covered under there.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I'll pull that out. That's my set.
Yeah, great.
And sometimes it goes where my office is, and depending on what the set is. I filmed just last week. I covered those trees with Christmas decorations and did a Christmas shoot for Dilmar. So, you know, there's now I can do all of that in one space in a controlled environment.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's good.
Perfect.
And hopefully other people will want to use it too. Book launches, voiceovers. Like when I did book launches, I used to always have to fly to Sydney because there are very few studio kitchens, and if you do a cookbook launch, you need to actually cook the food for the photographer, and he'll shoot it as you go. So there's an opportunity there. I see lots of
potential
for not just myself but other people as well.
Yeah, great. There you go. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Everyone Has a Story. My guest, Peter Kuravita. And if you did enjoy the episode, please, we'd love a 5-star rating and a review of our podcast on Apple Podcasts, or maybe you listen via Wooshka or Stitcher. And feel free to share the episode about on your social media platforms. Until next time, take care.